Hello and welcome to Bat Trips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with the British twist. I'm your host today, Tom Pringle. We've got a special podcast today with a double interview. First off, we have my co-host Ben Carto, who's going to be speaking to Benny Howe, who's the English cricketer who has started to bring the knuckleball into cricket. Then we have myself speaking to Brian Wright, the sabre writer who's recently released his excellent book, Mets in Tens. It's the best and worst of an amazing history. And if you listen carefully, there'll be a special competition for one or two copies of this fantastic book. So listen out later on the show for the special instructions. So first off, let's cut to Ben and his chat with Benny.
All right. So I am delighted to be joined by Benny Howe, who is a professional cricketer and a self-confessed baseball nut. How are you doing, Benny?
I'm not bad, thanks. Not bad. Looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, me too. So for those that don't know, Benny, as I said, is a professional cricketer who buys his trade in England for Gloucestershire within the county setup. You were the top wicket taker in 2016, as I found out, in the T20 tournament with 26 wickets. And you also have an interesting knuckle slurball inspired by your passion for baseball, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later on. I thought I'd start off. I'm rubbish at hosting, by the way. It's like my first time doing an interview, so do forgive me if I'm rubbish.
No drama.
I thought we'd start off talking about what you've been up to sort of this winter and this summer, because it took us a little bit of time to get this interview set up. So, yeah, what's it been like for you over the last couple of months?
Well, as soon as season ended, end of September, October was completely off as a squad for Gloucestershire, but I had to sort of carry on training because I had the Bangladesh Premier League in November, December. So I went out, I was training, went over there, played in that. Unfortunately, only played one game, but did all right in that for the one game I played. And then it's pretty much been just training all winter. I went to Australia and was out there training with one of the big bash sides with the Renegades. But unfortunately, I had, you know, two big dog overseas, so I couldn't get in there. So it's just pretty much been training full on since then, really, working on a lot of variety of things.
Sounds good. Yeah, you mentioned the travelling abroad. That's something that a lot of cricketers I know do these days. It sort of adds to the schedule a little bit, I suppose. There's no real time off if you are doing all that travelling and training and playing as you were in Bangladesh. Is that a little bit arduous for you? Do you feel like you've had any time off?
Yeah, I have had time off. I'm obviously over Christmas. Since I was over there training in Australia, it was sort of on my own accord. I could go and I wasn't playing any matches, so I could go in there and just work around, you know, my own schedule, which is quite nice to do sometimes, especially out in the sun in Australia, because a lot of the guys are stuck indoors in the winter, you know, in the gym, on all the bowling machines indoors, and that can be a bit of a drag. So it wasn't too bad. It was nice to be out there training.
Yeah, I'm sure you won't get a lot of sympathy for spending a summer in the Australian sun. Now, I can't help but notice exactly that on your Crick Info page, it says that you're a dual UK Australian passport holder. Mm-hmm. So where does your allegiance lie in the Ashes? I've got to ask.
No, obviously England. I've got to say that. No, obviously England, because I'm English qualified. Mum's Australian. They're actually, my whole family live out there, but I grew up pretty much in England. So, yeah, I wanted our boys to do well. Unfortunately, Australia were too good.
I'm glad to hear you're an England fan, at least, even if it meant you're on the wrong side of the result.
I actually get frustrated by the Australian club cricketers. They think they're better than they are. So I was actually even more supporting England in that sense, but it didn't work out this time.
Bit of friendly rivalry. I love it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, there's a good rivalry, but yeah, I do like to shut them up sometimes because they can talk when they're winning.
I'm sure. So I guess just let's start with the baseball. The first question would kind of just be why. I mean, not many people get into baseball in these parts. So what made you sort of draw towards the sport?
About 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I went to America for the first time. Didn't really know much about baseball. Obviously, I knew baseball, didn't follow it. And then I was in Miami, went to watch the Marlins play the Philadelphia Phillies. It wasn't really a great game, but I was just, from pretty much the first pitch, I was just absorbed into the whole game, really, and how it worked. And I was asking millions of questions. I was just like, this is uncannily sort of similar to cricket, but so different at the same time. So from that point on, I went to Australia that winter, well, English winter, Australian summer, and played some club baseball because I was just like, I've got to play this. And then I've sort of been hooked ever since. And obviously it has, yeah, a little bit of it is filtered into my cricket. So no, I still love it. I still follow it. So, you know, it was sort of a bit of a game changer really for me.
Oh, that's awesome. I had no idea you'd actually had a go at playing it out in Australia. That's cool. In terms of first games, yeah, Marlins, Phillies, even 5 or 6 years ago. Do you have a team yourself? Did I in your heart?
Yeah, because when I was out there, I met my my wife, who's from Miami. So I unfortunately sport Miami in all sort of forms over there in NFL and the baseball, because they're not that good. But that's who I follow. So got to stick with them.
Well, yeah, you have my condolences as far as the baseball team's concerned. But I suppose it is very British to support the underdogs. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, I support Everton and football as well. So we're sort of struggling with the teams I support.
Pretty used to losing. Yeah, nice, easy transition.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, in terms of how you follow the sport, are you someone who watches as much of it as you can? You keep up with just your team? How would you say you keep up with baseball during the season and the players?
No, I follow it. I get the Major League app, the baseball app, and I watch all the games, and I try and watch as many as I can, because it's quite easy just to sit and have it in the background and watch bits and pieces. So I follow most of the teams. I love the Red Sox. Now, obviously, they're quality to watch. And when Big Papi Ortiz, when he played, I think he's retired now, isn't he? He was awesome to watch. I went to see another game when I went to America. I was in San Francisco. I went to see Oakland Athletics versus Detroit, one of the playoff games 3 years ago. So that was good fun.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I've never been to see a playoff game, but I'm sure it's something that's on every baseball fan's bucket list. That must have been a cool experience.
It was good because it was only 1-0, but I think I saw Cabrera hit a home run to get that one up for Detroit. I think it was game 7 of quarterfinals, but they call it something else, like the
divisional series, I imagine. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Well, that was back when the Tigers were pretty good, so it must
have been quite fun. Good. So I enjoyed it. Yeah, I love it.
Good stuff. I didn't realize you were quite so into it. Now, did you go to MLB Battlegrounds last year, the big event they had at Hyde Park?
No, I saw it though with Josh Butler and Hales. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
I didn't go, but I heard about it.
Big question then. Could you have done a better job than they did?
Josh Butler can hit the ball pretty well, but it's still very, very different how you hit a baseball to a cricket ball. And from playing that myself, then I reckon I'd give him a go. Good go for sure.
I think they were quite surprised with how different it was in terms of translating cricketing ability to baseballing ability. I know you've got experience obviously playing both of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what sort of your thoughts in terms of how the two sports compare and maybe any inspiration you've taken from one towards the other?
Well, it's a big question that. In terms of a general sense, I think it very much relates to T20 cricket. You know, the bowlers are trying to stop the batters from hitting as much runs as they can, and the pitchers in baseball are trying to stop the batters from them hitting home runs and getting runs on the board as well. So in that sense, it's very similar. But the difference in it is obviously just the techniques and the biomechanics of everything is just slightly different. So there's a lot more sort of work on biomechanics in baseball to cricket, whereas cricket's is a lot more variety that can go on. So it's quite hard to just stick to sort of very one sort of simple power swing, with batting, because you can hit 360, or bowling, you've got a lot of different lengths you can bowl. In baseball, you're generally throwing around the same area. So it's funny, isn't it? It's very similar, but also in that respect, it's quite different. So I'm just very intrigued by it all, really.
Yeah, no, it is interesting seeing sort of how the two sports compare. Because like you say, when you look at the like pure mechanics of pitcher, batter or bowler, batsman, you would think they'd be similar, but they are different. But it seems like some batsmen, especially in T20 cricket, are maybe using the ideas that baseball players have in terms of leverage, getting the ball in the air, keeping their weight back. I don't know if that's something that is sort of being done.
Our team, we have a Julian Wood, who's actually a specific power hitting coach, and he's got all his stuff from baseball. And he's been brilliant. Like he's not saying you should hit like a baseballer, because you're going to get different types of lengths and balls. You've got to play balls at your body. In baseball, you let it hit you or you move. But in terms of getting cricketers to think more like baseball power hitters, sluggers, for example, in T20 cricket is definitely the mindset for sure. And being able to hit lengths that they wouldn't have thought possible 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So it's becoming bigger and bigger in that for sure. And in terms of pitching, like in bowling, people are coming out with lots of different slur balls and this and that. And that's basically what pitchers do, isn't it? They come up with they work the bats, they work the hitters, the batters over with their different balls. And that's how they go about it. Whereas cricket hasn't always been like that, but for sure it's changing.
Yeah, that's right. One of the big sayings for pitching in baseball was certainly keeping the hitter off balance, which is something that definitely translates to the sort of Schumer formats in the game in cricket, where making sure the batsmen can't obviously get their timing right is essential. Now, I know you've got some experience. You talked about slow balls a little bit. I've sort of read a little bit about your use of knuckleballs. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what you've taken from baseball?
Well, I always thought the knuckleball was thrown like deep in the knuckles, whereas, and I actually saw it, and that's how I started throwing it, really. I was pitching in club baseball, and I started throwing it like that, and it came out sort of funny and didn't come out perfect when I threw it. But I just thought, maybe I'll just try it when I bowl. And it was one of those things where it just came out nice straight away. But I don't hold it exactly like I think R.A. Dickey and maybe one of the other guys, I think he holds it in his three fingers in the nails, but I hold it more in the knuckle. So I just find it more comfortable, but it's a similar effect. But with a cricket ball having a seam over just the middle of the ball, you can get obviously the knuckle to swing more so in your control with the sort of knuckle pressure on it. So sort of developed it a little bit further, but that's how I originally sort of started, because I always thought baseball and the knuckleball, and that's was sort of the first one I went to. And actually, since starting it and bowling it, it's become a real sort of powerful weapon for me, considering I'm not bowling that fast compared to a lot of the bowlers we have. So the knuckleballs definitely helped me out a lot.
Yeah, it's cool to hear that you sort of went to that idea of taking speed off it. And obviously in baseball, a big part of the knuckleball is taking all the spin off the ball so it can kind of move weirdly in the air, which obviously in cricket would be a huge advantage, where maybe you wouldn't get your sort of standard swing that you would, you know, with a new ball or something. So it's interesting to hear about that. And you mentioned sort of like how for you it's been important because maybe you haven't, you know, bowled as fast as some of the traditional quicks that are in your team too. So is that something again where you can kind of use you know, the knuckleball or any other versions of that in terms of just mixing your speeds up and, like I say, keeping guys off balance?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, it's not just about mixing speeds up. I mean, changing up speeds important, don't get me wrong, but a lot of the time we talk too much about changing speeds. It's actually about the movement of the slow balls as well. So if I can get this knuckleball to move slightly or get it to sort of drift slightly late or whatever, same with any sort of spinning delivery, if you can get it to move as well as being a change of pace, then you're obviously even more in the game. And I think that's when obviously the best pitchers are. Obviously they've got to be accurate, but when they get those change ups and everything, they move late, not just a change of pace, but actually move, I think that's just as important. And that does keep the batsman off balance. And actually, I found, especially last year and the year before, you know, I got a lot of wickets from that as well. So just sort of subtly deceiving in that way as well. So it's been huge, the knuckleball.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned obviously having a lot of success with it, especially in a short format of the game. Is there anything that you especially attribute sort of how well you've done in 2020 cricket? Is that just something that your game's moulded well towards, or do you think that you've been better maybe at adjusting your style of bowling for short formats and in terms of what batsmen are going to do, and maybe if they're more aggressive, that benefits you?
Benefits me for sure, because if I'm bowling in 4-day cricket, I think unless I'm, you know, making the ball swing and move ridiculously, which is pretty hard with a knuckleball, it's always late movements. Unless that I'm doing that, then they can easily sort of defend it if they really want to and just sit on me and wait for another bowler or whatever. And in 4-day cricket, 5-day cricket, it's all about taking wicket. So I find I've definitely more chance to take wicket when they're swinging and they're swinging the ball and I'm keeping them off balance that way. That's how I get my wicket. So I'm definitely suited more to T20 in terms of my bowling for sure.
And batting wise, I know you probably said yourself a bowler first, but you've contributed some pretty handy knocks, it looks like, over the last couple of years for your county. Is that something that you want to focus on more going forward, or do you consider yourself a bowler first and kind of how are you going to contribute with the bat is kind of cherry on top?
I have to. I've opened the batting right at the end of the last year and in the 4-day and batting has always been my first suit growing up. Obviously it's changed a bit, but I'm trying to get back into that as well, because that's going to get me playing for England and in more franchise tournaments, because at the minute they're not sort of seeing me as a bowler, maybe because I'm that in between someone, I'm something different, they're not really sure yet. So I think hopefully they can warm up to that idea, but for sure if I can become a dangerous hitter as well, which I'm on the verge of but not quite there yet, then it's definitely going to help me down the line for sure. So I'm working on that. I'm working hard on that as well.
That's interesting. Yeah, well, you certainly see the value nowadays in cricket of guys who can kind of contribute everywhere, and maybe not the best batsman, but can add some runs late in the innings. And like you mentioned, I know you opened the batting in the four-day game at the end of last year. That's cool to see. That's something you're focusing on this season. I find it interesting that in baseball, obviously, until this season at least, you have guys that are fully specialised on pitching and on hitting. This year we've got Shohei Ohtani of the Angels, who looks like he's going to give his go at doing both, maybe not on an everyday basis, but a fair bit. Is that something that you think baseball maybe could learn from cricket in terms of, because I know a lot of these young guys growing up have been doing both, but obviously when they get older, they specialise.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think they could sort of take inspiration from?
Imagine, of course. I mean, they're very sort of set in their ways, the Americans, but I think they can learn from us as well as we can learn from them. Because imagine if you've got a guy who can pitch at 95 plus and then hit the ball out of the park and hit the ball well consistently. So imagine drafting someone like him, he'd be worth a lot of money, right? So for sure. And also another thing baseball I feel like they could expand on is, which is the power hitting coach talked about, who coaches us, Julian Wood. He talks about them hitting outside the zone. So they're very set on leaving balls outside the zone and being patient, which is great. But I reckon a lot of baseballers could actually hit more outside the zone and hit and expand the zone area for them to hit. That's another thing I think they could learn with cricket, because we obviously hit in all or wherever the ball is, really, unless it's really wide.
That's an interesting thought, yeah, because I guess in baseball the tradition's always been that if it's not in the zone, you don't want to swing at it, but maybe there's not been enough thought into, well, if we do swing it, maybe we can do more damage with those pitches.
Well, I think there was one hit last year. I think it was Prince. What's his name? Prince Lefty.
Prince Fielder, maybe?
Yeah, Prince Fielder, yeah. And he hit one, I'm not kidding, it was probably almost half a meter above the zone, a fastball. And he whacked it for, I think, a triple, a double, triple, and it was just like, it can be done. So, yeah, that's something they could learn.
Yeah, you do get some of these freak athletes who can, yeah, hit those pitches that maybe they're coached for years not to try and swing at, but these guys are such freak athletes that maybe it could be an advantage to go after a few more of them.
Obviously, it depends on the type of player, but I reckon more players could definitely expand their zone to hit, for sure.
Now, you mentioned you played a bit of baseball yourself in Australia. What was your position? What were you best at?
Well, they chucked me at centre field because me getting used to the mitt took me a while to the baseball glove. So it was sort of the easiest position for me to play. And I throw the ball quite hard, I was sort of a closing pitcher, if you like. So I'll come in from centre field and close the game out, just try and just throw as hard as I can, strikes, with a few knuckles in there.
Oh, that's cool. How'd you find it? Did you pick it up quickly?
Loved it. No, I threw it. The hardest bit was actually the mound, just getting used to when you land, you go down the slope and throw. But I loved it. I honestly fell in love with it. I was actually so close to quitting cricket and deciding to try and make it in the minor leagues first and go to baseball, but that would have been a very rash decision.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's cool. Well, I know that in Australia it's much bigger.
Yeah, but it was, it's probably, it would have been a long way, long hard work to do that, a lot of hard work. Get to that stage, so it was not worth with the position I was in with cricket, for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure that's kind of thing. When you sit down and think about it maybe isn't quite so much.
Yeah, maybe if I was 18 and stuff, but no, it was also mid-20s. And
no, yeah, I mean, to be fair, I thought myself about giving up the day job and giving baseball a go, but the first minute I walked onto the field, it became pretty clear that wasn't going to be a viable career path.
Yes, but yeah, sometimes just, you know when it's not quite right.
I'm sure. Did you find anything when you first started the sport frustrating? You mentioned getting used to the glove. Was it the kind of thing where you expected to immediately be great at it and maybe it was harder than you thought?
Yeah, it was, because, you see people catch the mitt, they make it look so easy, but actually when you're not used to it, it's pretty difficult. It took me time, but I got used to it in the end, sort of. And the sort of little rules around base running and stuff takes you a while to get used to. And I still can't believe how far they hit it. Like, to hit a home run, I was like, I couldn't hit a home run. I could only just, like, maybe if I sliced it right field and just got the right connection, could maybe just, but otherwise couldn't do it. I'd have to get in the gym, you have to get strong. These guys, like the hitters, they're incredible, the way they hit. I guess it's a lot to do with biomechanics and working out, the time of the hip and the swing, and obviously strength and power work as well, which is huge there, which actually has come into cricket a lot more. So I was amazed by how far they hit it, really.
Yeah, no, I was too. I think maybe you don't realize when you see it on TV quite how far it is. It's a bit like the first time you realize how tall a basketball hoop is. You think, how does anyone ever dunk? how does anyone ever hit a home run? Because it's a long way when you get on the field.
It's ridiculous. I just can't. It's unbelievable. They're just monsters, some of them.
Now, I was going to ask if there was anyone from sort of clubs you played with or around the county championship scene that you think would be well suited to take up Major League Baseball. But I think from our conversation so far, you probably pick yourself, being modest, even though you don't have to be.
In the world cricket stage, you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, are there any other cricket players you know that are big baseball fans or that are into it at all?
I know. I think it's more the Southern Hemisphere guys. They follow baseball. The New Zealanders, the Aussies follow baseball a lot. I know that. I'm not sure which ones. Right? They obviously get a lot more baseball played than I think over here in England. But I'm a bit of a badger when it comes to baseball. So I talk a lot about baseball around the team, and they're probably bored of me by now. But there's a few of them who enjoy listening and talking about it, especially pitching, I think, more so. Trying to think of players who'd be good. You obviously got your Gale. I think someone like Gale could probably pick it up. I mean, he would have to change his swing slightly, but someone who's that still and that powerful would be pretty amazing. Couldn't really think of anyone else right now, but I'm sure Ben Stokes, maybe he's one of those who probably could pick it up quite quickly.
He's an incredible athlete, isn't he?
Carlos Brathwaite. Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of those guys with their power and their ability to stand and deliver. You think they'd be very well suited to baseball.
Well, I think, what's his name? Kieran Powell tried it, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He definitely gave it a go somewhere for a little bit. I never found out how he got on, but
he didn't get drafted. I think he definitely got scouts from a few different like Mets and Yankees, but I don't know how true. I mean, he was sort of putting on social media, so he's now back in the West Indies cricket team. So I don't really know. He obviously didn't get drafted or anything, but maybe got some minor league opportunities. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what he thought of it, giving it like a proper go and some proper game for a while. Yeah.
I think you've got to really stand out to be able to transfer. I think unless you're really young, I think you've got to really stand out to go mid-20s and plus. Otherwise, you've sort of got no hope. But obviously, it can happen. You never know.
Yeah, that's a tough bit. You've got all these guys, I mean, incredible athletes who are amazing at their own sport. But when you compare them to guys who've been playing baseball for, 25 years, it's tough to compete.
I think Boomer Collins tried to make, if you heard of him, went from trying to make baseball to cricket.
He's still trying,
I don't know if he's trying to do it still, but he played minor leagues in the Toronto Blue Jays setup, but he was playing minor leagues there, and he's sort of trying to play cricket, I think. But I'm not sure how he's getting on. He hasn't made any major comps yet.
No, yeah, that's interesting. Well, it is a bit of a slog through the minor league, so it's probably a name to look out for in the next couple of years.
Never know. I mean, I don't know if he's carrying on, but I remember last year they were putting on social media a lot and he was giving it a good crack.
So yeah, I can imagine. On the flip side, then, are there any...
I wouldn't believe it's harder for a baseballer to come to cricket, personally, but you never know.
Yeah, I was literally about to ask, if you're going to pick a single baseball player that you think might handle himself best out on the wicket, either bowling or playing, I guess.
A single baseball player? It's quite tough, really. It's probably more the guys, who are smarter at the crease or at the hitting box. I always forget the phrases used in baseball. Obviously, power's all great, but in cricket, you sort of got to have the nous as well. So sort of more the guys who are like, I reckon someone who's just so good at baseball, like Derek Jeter or something, could probably pick up cricket if you give him time. I reckon, just because they're so talented.
Yeah, no, that's a good idea. And he's also he's so good at fielding that he'd probably pick up that aspect of it quickly and be pretty valuable.
I think so. The fielding should be all right, but they obviously got to use to catching a cricket ball with hands, which would be a bit different. But the throwing will be obviously top draw. I don't know. We couldn't see a pitcher coming to bowl because they've got to use a straight arm. But as a batter, maybe, depending on the type of
batter. Very scary adjustment going from glove to bare hand and from throwing to bowling might be a bit tricky for a few of them.
I reckon actually maybe Hunter Pence could be different because he's so different on it. I reckon he hits some weird balls downfield. So I reckon he could come to cricket.
That's a great shout. Yeah, he's not got to change too much to be able to mix it up.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know.
No, that's good stuff. Well, I know you've got a dash off soon, so I won't keep you for much longer, but appreciate you joining us.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, no, it has been fun. I'm sure that our listeners will be looking out for you this season, looking out for that knuckleball. Hopefully it serves you well.
Yeah, hopefully I have a few new deliveries I can name.
And yeah, look, if you ever do decide to make the switch, then you've definitely got a few fans here who'll be eager to see how you get along.
Never know. Might make a little switch later on.
Awesome. Okay. Have a good one. Cheers, mate.
Thanks, mate. No worries. Catch ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Ben. We're now going to move on. So my guest, as I said earlier, is a writer who featured in and on Bleacher Report, The Washington Examiner, Nesson.com, SB Nation, The Cauldron. He's also was the lead MLB writer for the Sports Daily, and he's also completed a large amount of work for the Society for American Baseball Research, which is shortened down to SABRE. He's also contributed to a book about the great games at Wrigley Field. It's the author of Mets in Tens, our special book tonight, and it's Brian Wright. How are you, Brian?
Oh, I'm doing great today, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. So so the eagle eyed who noticed our Twitter account will notice that this is the second time we've actually recorded this. So you and I have now met up for two nights this week to talk through this due to my technical technical problems.
Technical difficulties. The first one was a warm-up.
Yeah, it was a warm-up. And you know what? I think this one will be better. We'll probably have less chat about Bartolo's belly, who took a comebacker off his belly the other night, which is interesting.
He's a marvel, to say the least.
What is he now, 45 years old and he's still pitching?
Yeah, I think he's going to be 45 next month.
Incredible. Right, let's go straight into it then. So let's talk about how you first got into baseball. I think for most British fans, it's not something we grow up with, but I imagine for you, it was something you grew up with your parents maybe getting you into it?
Yeah, like most of us here in the United States, my inspiration came from family, specifically my father's side of the family. My grandfather was my whole family's from New York. My grandfather was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. And once they left, like most Brooklyn Dodgers fans, they transferred their allegiance elsewhere. He became a semi-Mets fan, but that was enough to influence my dad, who fell in love with the Mets in their first season, 1962. And he passed his love for baseball along to me. I went to my first game in 1992. I was 5 years old. He had the 86 Mets highlight video. He had the 25th anniversary video, which is also from 86. I loved watching those. I wore out those VHS tapes. And those three things combined created the obsession that led to where we are now. So certainly, yeah, my dad has a lot to do with it. My mom is not a baseball fan, but my mom's father was a huge Yankee fan, but that didn't have any effect on me. It was my dad.
Oh, it would have been good to see your dad and your wife's father getting involved in a ding dong battle between the Mets and the Yankees.
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, my grandfather was my mom's side. Every time we would talk about the Mets, he would almost talk about them and kind of if they're doing well, that's cute, like, you know, okay, a little you know, this redheaded stepchild kind of.
I love that. It's brilliant because you just think, like, I mean, the Yankees, everyone else must just be so insignificant at that period where they were just smashing a load of championships. Everyone else must have just been completely insignificant, like no matter who they were facing in the World Series, they must have just rolled their eyes and gone, oh well, never mind.
Yeah, the Mets, when they play in the Subway Series against the Yankees, the victories to the Mets mean so much more to the Mets, especially their fans. We kind of have, I joke, we kind of have an identity crisis where we're always striving to be the team in New York. We have that issue where the Yankees don't have that issue. In fact, I don't think they really care about beating the Mets, certainly not to the extent that we care about beating the Yankees. And it's funny, if you were to put the Mets, you were to take the Mets and put them in another city, a small market city, say Pittsburgh or Baltimore or, you know, Milwaukee, their successes and failures wouldn't be as prominent. I mean, you know, you wouldn't, they wouldn't get as noticed in New York, especially, being sized up against the Yankees. I mean, the Mets' success paired up with the Yankees or put up next against the Yankees is like an ant against the Empire State Building. It's just, it's almost unfair. So the Yankees, they see the Mets as, you know, kind of just being there, just another baseball, the other baseball team, where the Mets kind of look at it as the team that we have to get take the attention from. And sometimes sometimes they get they get the back pages, as they put it in the New York tabloids. They get the back pages, but for more often than not, it's for the bad reasons.
Well, let's not get into Matt Harvey just yet. But it's very similar to I'm sat here now in my Padres hat. It's very similar to the Padres, the fact that, you know, it means so much to them to beat the Dodgers, but the Dodgers don't really care if they beat the Padres. Although that wouldn't really be true at the moment, because the Dodgers are actually below the Padres in the standings. Mm-hmm. I think those victories then just become so much more sweeter, don't they, when you're that little team?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I could, you know, remember some of the, in one of the chapters in the book is a Subway Series victories chapter. The game in 1999, where they got a game winning base hit. The Mets got a game winning base hit by Matt Franco off Mariano Rivera to drive in the final two runs. I mean, that was a great game in itself, but it was made so much better because it was against the Yankees. I mean, if it had been a victory against the Dodgers or, you know, the Rockies or something like that, it wouldn't be as memorable. But when it's on that New York stage, it's heightened nationally, but it's such a big deal in New York.
Yeah, it's huge. So before we get into the book, just let us know how you got into writing to begin with. Was it a passion you always wanted to do, or was it something you kind of fell into?
Well, when I fell in love with baseball, I naturally fell in love with kind of the great orators of the game, you know, the Vin Scullys, the Bob Costases. I would stay up late in college watching Dodgers games just so I could hear Vin Scully, because, you know, what, 10 years ago, I thought he was retiring, and it turned out it was about 8 years later. So I loved reading the great baseball writers. I mean, living in Washington, D.C., I got to read Tom Boswell, who's still a great writer for the Washington Post. I had a bunch of books on baseball history, on Mets history, certainly. I loved listening to games on the radio. So I always had an affinity for just baseball media in general, sports media specific, in a broader sense. So I always had a passion to try to be somehow involved in baseball media, whether it was broadcasting or writing, and writing always seemed to click for me. It was just kind of the easiest avenue for me to go through. And I wrote for the student newspaper in high school, the student newspaper in college, had some side jobs while I was, you know, having a regular career. So it's always been, I had a podcast. So I always had a slight interest in doing audio work, but the writing's been kind of, like I said, it's been the easiest path to take.
Yeah. Did you ever actually play baseball when you were in college or anything?
No, I never. I was not good enough to play in college or high school. So, as much as I love baseball, I was not particularly good at it. Running, I'm more of a runner. So I guess if they want to put me as a pinch runner in college, I think I could have done that, but. I was certainly not good enough to play. I mean, other than just playing intramurals.
I only wonder, because like sometimes you find when I listen to On Baseball Writing with Eric Roseberry, which is an excellent podcast. Mm-hmm. And whenever he talks to people, there's sometimes that split of they always wanted to play baseball, then couldn't do it, and decided that the only way they could really get in and still be part of the game was to do writing. And then, you know, whether it went into analytics, so metrics, then went into a front office. I just wonder if you sort of had that push to begin with to try and play the game and then went into writing. But no, it was more you enjoyed the literature, you enjoyed the history, and then built up from there.
Yeah, and the old saying is, I'm gonna butcher it, but the old saying about sports writers is they're all failed athletes. I guess I fall into that. I failed earlier than most.
It's kind of like, and it's going to be a very niche reference here, but it's kind of like navigators in the Air Force. I'm in the Royal Air Force, and it's kind of like navigators in the Air Force. They're all failed pilots. Nobody joins to want to be a navigator. They're all failed pilots. Yeah. Anyway, enough niche references of the Air Force. So let's talk about the book then. What was your inspiration for the book then to come up with it and the way it is? Now, I'll just give a quick description for people. So with it being called Mets in Tens, each chapter has a list of 10. And the chapters consist of things like beginnings, on the mound, at the plate, anguish, the clubhouse, noteworthy games, champions, best of the best. Then those chapters are all split down, for example, opening days, early Mets debuts, rookie seasons, and they go through all the different chapters. And each one has got
10 major points within those areas. Now, they're short, sharp paragraphs, which make it a great book and easy to pick up and go. So what was your inspiration for that, rather than doing like a larger novel with interviews, etc.?
Yeah, I always wanted to do some kind of book that was kind of like my postgraduate project. Other people go to, you know, law school or go to medical school. I had no enough talent to do that or pursue that. So I always wanted to write a book. And as you had mentioned in the open, I was writing for Bleacher Report, Washington Examiner, the Sports Daily. Those were great opportunities. Specifically, the Sports Daily and Bleacher Report, I did a lot of list writing, which is great to generate debates, generate interest amongst the readers. And I was watching the 2015 playoffs, the division series between the Dodgers and the Mets, and the play where Chase Utley, I think it was the seventh inning, game two, the play where Chase Utley runs into Ruben Tejada at shortstop, breaks Tejada's leg, gets away with it, even though he didn't touch second base. It was an incredibly dirty play. Got away with it, wound up scoring, and the Dodgers wound up winning that game. Of course, they didn't win the series. Once that happened, I thought back to, you know, his time with Philadelphia and the times he tortured the Mets then, and said, well, you know, I wonder where Chase Utley fits in the list of Met villains players that exercise their greatness against the Mets, and figured, you know, maybe he's higher than Chipper Jones. Maybe he's still lower than Chipper Jones. And then the next year he wound up, to killing the Mets again. But I started thinking about that, and I started thinking, well, who are the top 10 villains? And then I said, well, what other top 10 lists could I do? And if I was ever going to write a book, as I got back to, I always wanted to write a book. And if I was going to, it might as well be the Mets, because that's the area which I have the most useless, the most knowledge of. So I combined my knowledge of the Mets and the list writing that I had been doing, and just went from there. It was a slow go at first, because I thought it was going to be independently published. And then Arcadia Publishing and History Press took this on. They were able to take this project on, which I'm extraordinarily grateful for. And it picked up over, you know, the last year and a half. So that's how it really – that's it's funny. My anger in that Chase Utley play was unleashed over the next it kind of got the ball rolling on, you know, what – a three-year project.
I mean, I'm so glad that happened, because this book is brilliant. And for people who aren't even Mets fans, this is worth getting to read through, because it's just like I said, it's all short and sharp, and it's great. You can just pick it up. You can read a few bits, put it back down. You don't need to try and follow along in the narrative, etc. And it's always good to try and find your favorite areas. So, I mean, I think one of my favorite areas in the book is probably the at the plate chapter, mainly for the tiny Bartolo mention, which I was delighted to see. But what's your favorite chapter that you wrote, that you were putting together?
My favorite chapter, and it's going to go back to the villains chapter, because that's what started it all. That's kind of it's the first one that I really got finished. It's kind of the one that got it started. I enjoy writing about people the most, as opposed to the games itself, it's mainly just because of what I'm better at, and also because I think that people know mostly about what happened. When I write about the games, I try to write a little bit more about the emotion or what's not seen in a box score, because anyone can go to a box score on Baseball Reference and find out about said game. So I like writing about people, and I like writing specifically about people, like, you know, doing bad things. So I enjoyed also doing the internal feuds chapter, which is part of the in the clubhouse section five, if I'm not mistaken. I like doing that just because of the internal battles, you know, I guess I'm trying to think, Cleon Jones and M. Donald Grant, or, you know, Terry Collins and Jordani Valdespin back in 2013, that is quite hilarious if now looking back at it. But I also enjoyed the bus chapter, because it's just, you can kind of let loose on someone, and I think I did maybe a little too much on certain guys. So that was kind of fun. It was a combination of my two favorite things, writing about people and kind of, you know, laying the wood on certain people. And villains, like I said, was also fun, just because you could kind of talk about it. You can kind of almost unleash your anger on it.
I've got to make special mention for the managers chapter. My good friend and the most pessimistic Mets fan I know in the world, Stephen Edwards, was insistent that Terry Collins should be fired straight after the 2015 World Series. And all the way through, it was quite interesting reading his WhatsApps, which I looked at the other day, actually, just to sort of recall my memory of how pessimistic he was. The whole season, it was like, we're not going to do this. We got to the DS, not going to do this. NLCS, we're not going to do this. World Series, we're not going to do this. And when they didn't, it was very much like, ah, I told you so. It's like, no, Stephen, that's not how this works. Yeah. But it was great to see Terry in there. I was surprised to see him in there. So was he an easy inclusion?
Well, he's on the in the manager's list. He's fifth, and I think that's kind of appropriate because when you say pessimistic Mets fan, that's kind of an oxymoron. Well, that way, I'm not in love with Terry Collins, but I didn't hate him to the degree that some people did. I thought Terry Collins for the first few years, when he took over in 2011, I mean, he was taking over a team, a franchise that really was in financial straits, and he was there, in my opinion, to just kind of right the ship. And I think he did that. I mean, there were, with the exception, if I talked about the run in with Jordani Valdés being, with that exception, I mean, there was very little turmoil in the clubhouse. I think he kind of did a good job managing the media, which could certainly be intense in New York. And at the same time, I hate to say this, but they kind of won in 2015 in spite of him. I mean, he was good for keeping the clubhouse calm. So I think he was good for that. As far as strategy and bullpen use is concerned, I don't think he was moderately good. I mean, he was subpar at that. I mean, there were so many head scratching decisions. I mean, he would leave Michael Conforto out of the lineup way too many times that could be counted, more times than could be counted. And yeah, like you said, he would just overuse certain people from the bullpen, and it was just confounding to say the least. So at the end of 2017, I think it was certainly time for him to go. I like what they did. They just moved him to a front office position. I don't know what he does. I don't know if that was just a move just to please everyone, but like I said, fifth on the list. There are a lot of great Mets managers. Gil Hodges, Davey Johnson, Bobby Valentine, Willie Randolph, were good. So he fits right in at number five. He wasn't great, but he wasn't terrible.
Maybe they just ask Terry what to do, and then whatever he says, they just do the absolute opposite, and that's what he does.
Yeah, well, George Costanza theory. Yeah, no. And going back to that World Series, I mean, I think it's a little bit Monday morning quarterback to say that he had an influence on losing the World Series. I mean, specifically with Game 5, and as we touched on Matt Harvey, where he went 8 innings against Kansas City and then kind of pleaded to Terry Collins to go out in the ninth. And I was for him pitching in the ninth inning, and then he gives up 2 straight hits before getting it out. Terry Collins yanks him, and then Familia winds up letting that second run score. I think it was a 2-0 lead, and Matt Harvey gave the 2 hits, 1 run scores. Familia comes in, he winds up giving the other run after Lucas Duda throws the ball away, throwing it to home plate. So it's easy to blame Terry Collins for that, but I think it's revisionist history to go back and say that he was responsible in any way.
Yeah, it's so, like you say, it's so easy to look back and just complain about all the decisions he made. But, you know, whether he did get them there in spite of it or not, you know, he was there, he was still at the helm. So with your favourite chapter in mind, what was your toughest chapter? I mean, for me, it was difficult to read through the devastating losses where you got 3 separate paragraphs for the 2015 World Series. The fact that they got 3 games into devastating losses must have been pretty tough to write about.
That was tough. It was funny when I'm making the list up, I'm thinking of games originally, thinking of games off the top of my head, and it didn't register that like 2015 would have 3 different games among the top 10. I didn't think that was going to be even possible. It was not. I don't know. It was almost. I jokingly say I wrote it. I typed it while laying down on the couch upside down. So just going to a therapist. But it wasn't as hard as maybe some people think. I don't know. I don't know if I, it's a, the dark, my dark side. I can easily write about bad things, but it wasn't as hard as might have been believed. The toughest chapter, when I think of toughest chapters, I think of like tough to narrow down. And like the bus chapter was tough because I think you have two different distinct categories when you're talking about bus. And I grouped both of these categories in there for a lot of different reasons. I didn't want to repeat certain players again and again. So I had the two categories are the players that are like drafted by the Mets and never develop. And then there are the big name free agent signings, the big acquisitions via trade that never pan out. So you combine both of those and you have a lot of individual failures. So that was hard to narrow down. There are some in that are not on the list that I would totally, if someone said that person should be on there, I wouldn't have much of an argument with them. I guess from a macro perspective, the disappointing teams, which was not difficult. It was just, it was not as difficult to do that. But it was, I mean, there were not as many to narrow down to, surprisingly enough. The other two chapters that were difficult because of, like I said, the amount of entries, were the single game hitting performances and the single game pitching performances. Pitching, being, tougher, I think, well, maybe the hitting was tougher, but both were tough because as pitching, that's been kind of the Mets specialty over their franchise history. They have a pretty good pantheon of great pitchers from Seaver to Gooden, through, you know, up to now, you know, Jacob DeGrom. And they have a lot of great individual pitching performances, just one no hitter, but they have a lot of great pitching performances. And I was able to put in an honorable mention, which I think was necessary. The hitting performances, there are a lot of good hitting performances, but nothing, with the exception of maybe the top two, that really stand out. So when you get like to 8 and 9 and 10, it's just hard to say which one goes out and which one goes in. So those, the bus, the single game pitching and the single game hitting were the three toughest.
So with that in mind, trying to find space for all these hitting and pitching performances, is there any chapters that kind of went in there and then had to get cut last minute?
Oh yeah. There were two chapters that got cut, one much longer than another. There was one chapter I had an idea of, which was for top 10 uniforms. And that would have been great. The only problem was that we had kind of a restriction with regards to what pictures we could use. And it was hard to get, like, for instance, the number one uniform, I think, is their current white pinstripe uniform. The classic one. I love it. I think I had the uniform I love was only used for 1 year, was the 1987 road jersey, which had the scripted New York. And then they went to the block letters in 1988, or 88 through what, 92, or I think, but I don't, that was, that's an overrated jersey. But the 87 one, but long story short, I didn't have the ability to get enough photos to, because it was going to be, you know, one small entry and a photo, another small entry, then a photo. And we just didn't have the ability to do that. So I had to get cut. The other chapter, the much longer chapter that had to get cut just for word length, because we had a word limit, was the top 10 all-star moments, in which the Dwight Gooden performance where he struck out the side, I believe it was in the fifth inning. I know he went two innings, but the one inning where he struck out the side in 1984 at just 19 years old, pitching to Gary Carter, ironically, the year before he comes to New York. Also Jacob DeGrom, when he struck out the side in 2015 in Cincinnati. John Matlack winning the co-MVP in 1975. So that was a tough one to get rid of, but that was the most logical to leave on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, I've just had to quickly Google 1987 Mets road jersey, and I've got to agree, that is a good-looking jersey. Yeah.
I don't know why it lasted one season.
That's crazy. That's a great font on the front. If you haven't seen it, then do pause the podcast and go and search for this. 1987 Mets road jersey. That is beautiful. So I know we're short for time, so I'm going to quickly go over the next one then. So have you got a favorite moment or player from the book itself? Now, Tom Seaver gets the most mentions in his own chapter, so I'm guessing it must be him.
Yeah, Tom Seaver is my favorite Mets player. And I'm almost 31, so I never got to see him play. But yeah, he deserves his own chapter. He's the by far the best player the Mets have ever had. Their first Hall of Famer, and he was their only Hall of Famer until Mike Piazza. As far as a player on the active roster, I'm certainly partial to David Wright. No relation, sadly. Now it's hard because I don't know if I can call him an active player, and I don't know if we'll ever call him an active player again, which is quite unfortunate. But he's certainly one of the three best players the Mets have ever had. As far as players currently performing, Jacob DeGrom is my favorite, just because of how he can manage to get through even the worst situations. You see a lot of pitchers, they get in adverse conditions through their own doing or through someone else's, through, like, you know, an error. And they kind of it kind of spirals out of control. Jacob DeGrom is the opposite. He can seem to take, like, a bases loaded nobody out situation and make it where no one scores. I think he did that on Sunday in Philadelphia. It turned out to be his only inning, and it turned out to be a 45 pitch inning. But even when he's not at his best, he can manage to make it okay, and that's what impresses me the most about him. And as far as my favorite moment. I'll go quickly through it. My favorite game is the Game 5 of the 1999 NLCS, the Grand Slam single game. Robin Ventura getting the hit that turned out to be a single, sending the series back to Atlanta at rain-soaked Shea Stadium over 15 innings. That was the first year I remember the Mets going to the playoffs, so it was a memorable year, and that really was the climax of that season. A singular moment would be the first game after September 11th, the first game in New York after September 11th, the Mike Piazza home run in the eighth inning. I mean, that was the one time I felt like I had seen the future. When he got to the plate, not that it was much of a surprise to see Mike Piazza hit a home run, but when he came up to the plate, the Mets down by a run, 2-1 in the bottom of the eighth inning, with a runner on. It's almost like I saw him when I was watching on TV. It was almost like I saw him hitting the home run. I thought if this game is really meant to be special, he's going to hit this out, and then he hit it out, and that's a moment that transcends baseball. That was more than baseball, and it kind of affirmed that we can be normal in New York and in the country. So that was just that. That's I love watching it over and over because it doesn't get old. And as far as a particular stretch of time, from July 31st to the World Series in 2015, that was the most satisfying I've ever had, most satisfying time I've ever had being a Mets fan, specifically because I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and I got to see the Nationals fans have to accept that the Mets were going to win the division. All season, the Nationals being expected to take that division and being the heavy favorites. So all that kind of are the top memories I have, the top players and the top memories during my lifetime as a Mets fan.
Let's talk about those favorites then for the NL East before the season started, and your Mets as well. So after a blistering start, it's sort of slowed down a little bit, really.
Yeah, I think it's perfect timing with the book about the book being the best and worst, because we've experienced the best and the worst of this current team in the span of five, six weeks. I when they started out 11-1, I didn't think they were that good. I do think they're closer to what we're seeing now, and that's like a 500 team at best. There's far more to be concerned with than pleased with. I'm always worried about Yoenis Cespedes, because I can't remember the last time I didn't see him limping on a field. And now he's, it seems even though he wasn't at 100% strength, he was always seemed to be there, and he seemed to be getting better at the plate, and now he's on the disabled list. So who knows when he's really coming back, but that's a big concern, because if he's not playing, the Mets have no shot. And it just seems that the injury bug never stops gnawing at Cespedes for some reason. Michael Conforto concerns me. I know he hit that home run on Friday night against Philadelphia. That was hoped to be a spark for him and for the team, but for the most part, he hasn't hit the ball hard much at all. And that's concerning coming off that freak shoulder injury that ended last season. Another thing that's troubling is the lack of depth in the rotation. Jacob deGrom, I assume he'll be fine after that elbow scare. Noah Syndergaard, I think, will be okay. Zach Wheeler and Steven Matz are hit and miss. I mean, I know we don't expect pitchers to go the distance, maybe other than like Justin Verlander, but they can't even go like Wheeler and Matz can't even go like 5 or 6 innings, which is really which will put a real strain on the bullpen. So it's funny. Two, 3 years ago, we thought that the Mets, you know, the one thing they have no problem with is rotation depth. And right now I'm going, God, we need like a third person in the rotation to, it's amazing how quickly that happens, that we think we have everything all set. And then in no time, we need starting pitching. I don't think anyone would have thought we would be saying that a year ago. So, I mean, even more troubling than the internal problems are the other teams in the division. I mean, the Nationals, I still think, are the best team, but I mean, the emergence of the Braves and the Phillies, the Braves especially. The Braves are only going to get better. I mean, they're so young. I mean, they have like, the 3 or 4 youngest players in baseball. And I think they're a contender, and I mean, they're only going to improve. So the Mets are in a real difficult situation. I mean, not enough depth, and then the competition around them. I mean, those two things. I mean, that's going to make it very difficult to even reach the playoffs this year.
I think they were kind of quite spoiled, weren't they, to begin with? And the fact that, as you were saying, you've got the Braves and the Phillies not being so good, and the Marlins just being the Marlins. So they're kind of quite spoiled. They could pick up quite a few wins, which is great. But now that competition, as you said, is there, and it's causing problems. The DeGrom injury really does worry me quite a lot, especially as I've got him in one of my fantasy leagues. And to see him come back, like you say, literally that one inning and 45 pitches and was taken out straight away. I can't even remember. Did he even record an out at the end of that?
Well, he went through the first inning. I mean, he loaded the bases with nobody out and got through it in this, you know, I think it was 45 pitches and got through the top of the first. And I think it was the top of the second, they pinch hit for him, and that was it. So, I mean, he wasn't going to pitch long anyway, but it just, I think they were being very cautious. I don't think it's anything to be completely concerned with yet. I think it was just, they were being very, very cautious, and as they should be. I mean, he is their most important pitcher. I know Syndergaard is the most spectacular from how fast he can pitch, and just his presence on the mound. But Jacob deGrom is akin to Cespedes in the lineup. If they don't have Jacob deGrom, you can forget about any hope of the playoffs.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Syndergaard's fantastic to watch, but when he blows out, he blows out big. So how are you doing for time? Because I know you're quite short. Have we got time for any listener questions?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I have time for a couple.
Okay, cool. So we'll go first with then from New York Mets _UK. So it's NY Mets _UK. And they're saying, how hard was it to keep the franchise's biggest disappointments down to a list of 10? We kind of answered that, but have you got any more on that?
It was the like I said, the busts, that was difficult to narrow down, because there were so many, and there were, you know, the two subcategories of failed draft picks like Steve Chilcutt, who was one of only 3 number one picks that never made it to the big leagues. I think we just had our 3rd most recently. And then you combine that subcategory with the subcategory of the players acquired, the big name free agents and the big trade acquisitions, the Bobby Bonillas and the Jason Bays that just fell flat right when they got to the Mets. So that was hard to narrow down. And then as I said, and I was fumbling around with the answer before, but the disappointing teams was not as hard. It's funny because the Mets have had a lot of bad seasons, but they haven't had a lot of their bad seasons are because everyone thought they're going to be bad. 2017 was one of those years, and I had to insert this as I was writing the book. 2017 was one of those years where the Mets were supposed to be good, and of course they were horrid. So those seasons, 1992, 2009, there are, 10 disappointing seasons, but there aren't many disappointing seasons after that. So the bust was far, the individual disappointments were far more difficult to do.
And their second question then was the 10 most pivotal moments in Mets history, good or bad, kind of covered in the book, but I don't know if you want to throw a few out there.
Yeah, I mean, the 10 pivotal moments are kind of interspersed throughout the book. When I think of landmark moments, I mean, everyone thinks of the 86 World Series Game 6, and that's, you know, the landmark moment. 1969 is a landmark moment. When I look at pivotal moments in Mets history, I start with the hiring of Gil Hodges in 1968. He was the ideal person to have lead the Mets, who had, you know, never gone higher than ninth place in the worst team in the National League. And he takes them over in 1968. They were ninth in 1968, but they were improving. And of course, everyone knows what happened in 1969. They won 100 games. They beat the Cubs for the division. They beat the Braves in the NLCS, and they beat the Orioles in the World Series. I mean, Tom Seaver being drafted was great, but I don't think he would have succeeded without someone like Gil Hodges. And I don't think the team would have been able to do what they did unless Gil Hodges was there with his, fairly disciplinary style. No nonsense. He had no favorites. He was perfect for that team. I mean, no other manager could do what he did. And on top of that, Gil Hodges as a player, he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and it's a travesty that he's not there. The second most pivotal moment, and this is, this is the darkest moment in Mets history, is the trading of Tom Seaver, which was done in 1977, in June of 1977, after a feud with their chairman, M. Donald Grant, who was a guy who was an old style leader, was not in tune with the new player, was not willing to deal with free agency. He and Seaver had a big feud, and it ended with him being traded to the Cincinnati Reds. I mean, that was, to take a line from the college football, it was kind of a death penalty for the Mets, a self-imposed death penalty, because they were not good. They were the worst team in baseball for the next few years, and really didn't get good for another 7 years. Speaking of the 7 years, the next big moment, which was in 83, I guess 6 years later, the trade for Keith Hernandez, which is the best trade that the Mets ever made, because Keith Hernandez, not only with his bat and his glove, but his leadership, the Mets didn't have anyone like him. And he was important for that young pitching staff, that young team, an on-field leader, that the Mets got good after that, coupled with Daryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden coming into the fold, and then later Gary Carter. Then the trade for Mike Piazza in 1998. I mean, that was the Mets were a plucky, good team. They got Mike Piazza. They were a powerhouse. I mean, they were a good team. I wouldn't say powerhouse, but they were now a contender. And of course, they went to the playoffs in 99 and 2000 with Mike Piazza being the leader. And then the last most recent one is, I think, July 31st, 2015. I shudder to think if they didn't make the trade for Yoenis Cespedes, I mean, where would the Mets be? Would the Mets not have made the World Series? I wonder what would have happened. The trade for Yoenis Cespedes at the end of the trade deadline, and couple that with the Wilmer Flores walk-off home run against the Nationals that started the Mets to rising to the top of the division, and they never looked back. So those are kind of the pinnacle moments, I think, in the franchise history.
Yeah, that Cespedes trade. I think most people were just there pulling refresh on their Twitter every 2 minutes just to try and find out if he'd moved.
Quick story. I was at my office job on that day, and there was a guy who was like on detail at my office from New York. He lives in Queens, huge Mets fan, thick Long Island accent. And he was, for refreshing Twitter, I was doing no work. Refreshing Twitter, like you were saying, refreshing Twitter, because they were going to get, they were going after Jay Bruce, I think, at first, and that fell flat. And then it was, they might go after Cespedes. I mean, if they didn't make any deals, I mean, it was going to be scorched earth around Citi Field. I mean, it was going to be the fans were going to be picketing on the street. So, I was refreshing my Twitter, and it went from there. Well, they're not really going to get him. Well, they might get him. They're talking to the Tigers, and then they got him. Like, I see it 4:01, and I went to the guy who I was working with, who was in the office on detail. And all I said was, we got him. We got him. I was so excited. And then the home run to beat the Nationals by Wilmer Flores. I mean, that was the turning point of the 2015 season that led to the World Series. And it's funny, looking back, looking back, you kind of have a little regret because you kind of wish that season would have ended with the World Series victory, because when you don't win it, there's a lot of regret. But it was still special. I mean, that, like I said, that those 3 months were as much fun as I've ever had being a Mets fan.
That feeling of we got him is just so great. I don't know how many teams get to do this, but especially like for me as a Red Sox fan, getting Chris Sale was just incredible. I know the giveaway was quite big, but getting Chris Sale and JD Martinez has just been superb. And of course, the other big name, Mitch Moreland.
I mean, those trades. I mean, when you have like a game changing trade, when you have a guy that can flip a team from being so-so to being great. I mean, the Mets were about just barely better than a 500 team. I mean, they had those young, you know, they had the young pitchers, of course. Matt Harvey was having a good season, but their offense was horrid. I mean, they were doing nothing on offense. I mean, they're having John Mayberry Jr. in the cleanup spot. It was a joke whenever the Mets pitchers gave up a run. It's like, okay, we lost. I mean, fans were like succumbed to, okay, we're going to lose this game. So, Yoan Cespedes he made everyone in the lineup better. It was one of the best trades the Mets ever made, even if that's the only World Series that they get to while he's there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic trade. And yeah, it certainly sparked that offense, didn't it? Right. And so from David Tate, who's at Malted Met, one of our big friends of the show, he's put biggest Mets heroes and villains since the year he was born. And he follows it up by saying, yes, I was born in 62. So again, they're kind of covered, but any special extra mentions you want to go for?
Yeah, I mean, the heroes are pretty easy with Seaver, Tom Seaver, with David Wright, with Mike Piazza. I mean, those three. To me, I mean, David Wright, I think will have his number retired whenever he does retire. I mean, you'll see five up there on the rafters. Gil Hodges is another hero in Mets history for what he did and for what he did for that 69 team. Like I said, no one else could have done what he did with that 1969 Mets team. As far as villains, I touched on him, but M. Donald Grant, who had a feud with Cleon Jones, who was one of the best hitters, who had the feud with Tom Seaver. I mean, he came in. I mean, he was there from the beginning of the team, and he was a friend of the original owner, Joan Payson. And when Joan Payson died after 1975, the team was inherited by Payson's daughter, Lorinda DeRolay, and who really knew nothing about baseball, and just kind of ceded all baseball decision making to him, M. Donald Grant, who knew even less about baseball. He was just a guy who, like I said, didn't embrace free agency. He was, and I say this even as strong as it may sound, I think he was a plantation owner. He was not in tune whatsoever with how the modern baseball player. I mean, like I said, he questioned Tom Seaver when Seaver was signing up for a country club. I mean, he couldn't believe that Tom Seaver was kind of in this strata. So it was just very, you know, and also with the advent of free agency in 1975, I mean, M. Donald Grant wanted no business with it. I mean, he had no desire to pursue the free agency market, unlike George Steinbrenner just a few miles away. And when Seaver asked or pleaded for the Mets to get better hitters, specifically Gary Matthews, the Mets barely opened their checkbook. I mean, they didn't open their checkbook. They didn't even try. So, it was frustrating for Seaver, and that, and a, you know, war of words, ultimately led to Seaver being traded in June of 77, and it made M. Donald Grant, public enemy number one in Flushing. They called Shea Stadium Grant's tomb after that, because when you trade away a guy who is nicknamed the franchise, you trade away the franchise. It's kind of like an anchor. I mean, everything just goes south, and the attendance went south. The team went south in the standings. The team wasn't that great anyway, but Seaver was a gate attraction. I mean, he made fans interested in the team. So even to this day, even as Donald Grant is long gone, he's still the most hated of anybody who's been associated with the Mets. So he's the villain. He's the number one villain by far. I can't even think of a number two.
Do you think M. Donald Grant would quite like Twitter and Instagram in this modern day?
No, I don't think he would. He would be in tune with that either. I don't think he would like Yoenis Cespedes going and swinging a golf club, even though it seems to help him at the plate. So if I were him, I'd let him do it.
That's crazy, isn't it? Like that, and the problem is, there's still teams and owners like that exist. I mean, you look at the Orioles when it came to Shohei Ohtani, and they said straight off, they went, "We're not even going to put an offer in. We're not even going to try and attempt to woo him. It's just not our motto. It's just not what we do." And the fans must just look at that and just go, "Really? You're not even going to attempt it?"
Yeah, just at least show that you want to make an effort.
Yeah, just, you know what? Even if you just send him a letter saying we're interested, and he says I'm not. That's it. At least you've done it. You've physically done it.
Yeah, at least he turns you down. It's not like it's we didn't even make an offer, so we're not even gonna, we don't even want to hear the answer.
He could have been a lifelong Orioles fan, and they didn't even attempt it.
The Orioles could have used him.
Oh yeah, most certainly this year. It's ridiculous. Right, and so I know, again, I keep saying it, you're short of time, so let's quickly move on, and we'll drop in our competition here. So if you want to win a copy of Brian's fantastic book, we've got two copies available to us. All you need to do is email me, so that's tom@batflipsandnerds.com, or DM us on Twitter, and we're @batflips_nerds, and you need to send me a message telling me my favorite Mets moment of all time, which, as you all should know by now, was Bartolo hitting a home run off Big Game James Shield at Petco Park. I'm glad to see that made it into the book, Brian.
Yeah, there were moments that for a lot of reasons they couldn't make it into the book because it's just different types of lists. I wish I would have put like Anthony Young's long losing streak in from 92 to 93. Which was a lot of bad luck, but in any event, I wanted to put the Bartolo Colon moment. I mean, I had the chapter on greatest home runs. The Colon home run did not make it, but it's just so unique, and it was so wonderful when it happened that I had to put a photo with the caption on it, a photo of Bartolo Colon with the caption talking about that home run in San Diego. I mean, it was just a delightful moment. I remember when I was not present when the home run was hit. It was like Mother's Day weekend. I was with my mom, and I get back to my apartment, and all I see is on my phone, like alert, HR Cologne. I'm like going, something's wrong. This is not right. And I was like, but at the same time, I'm like going, maybe. And I run up to my apartment, and I get there just after it. And it was true. So it was, it was a delightful thing.
I was exactly the same. So as soon as that notification came through, I just went on Twitter, and it was just on fire. Just Cologne, Bartolo, everything was just running down my screen. I just couldn't keep up with it at all. It's one of the few, I don't know if you guys get these, but in the UK, we certainly get them on MLB.tv. We get one of those announcers saying, during this break in the action, here's a popular clip from MLB.com. And we just get to see the same clips regurgitated over and over again. That Bartolo one is the only one that still makes me smile to this day.
Yeah, no, we get the same thing. I wish that would be on more often because like you said, Gary Cohen's call of the home run on SNY, it just makes you smile.
It's the disbelief in his voice, and you can tell just the way he's talking. He's got this huge grin on his face as he's saying it. Brian, this has been absolutely fantastic. Your book, Mets in Tens, Best and Worst of Amazing History, is available on Amazon. You can get it in the UK. You can get it shipped over. It's not a problem at all. We're going to put links into the description. But this book is superb, and it's not just for Mets fans. It's for baseball fans as well. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Where can people find your work, and where are you on social media?
Yeah, on social media, you can find me on Twitter at BrianWright86. I'm on Instagram at BAWright86. You can follow the book on Facebook if you search Mets in Tens 10S. And then if you want to buy the book, it's on Amazon. It's on all the major bookseller sites. And if you like the book, please leave a review. Always most helpful. So a lot of different ways to get in touch to keep tabs on the book. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me.
Yeah, do so. Brian's been brilliant going back and forth with Mets fans as well when we first put the podcast out, and the fact there's going to be questions. I know one of the questions got answered through Twitter, which is great, Brian. We really appreciate that. So I've been your host, Tom Pringle. You can find lots of new and exciting writing on our website, batflipsandnerds.com. We've got a lot of writers come up in the last few weeks. There's a huge amount of posts gone out there now, so please do go and check it out. You can also subscribe on there to make sure you don't miss out on any of the posts. We're going to be doing another competition soon to win some London Series clobber, so make sure you keep an eye on the Twitter feed and the website. And do get subscribed to the podcast if you're not already. Subscribe to the website, as I said, and we've got the Twitter account to keep everyone up to date with everything that we're doing. So one final goodbye from me. So thanks very much, Brian.
Thanks so much, Tom. It was great to talk to you again.
Yes, the second time around. I think this one was better. I really do.
Yeah, I think the first one was like I said, spring training.
Well, hopefully it wasn't a Pablo Sandoval spring training, because his is usually great and then his season is terrible.
No, I think we both made the team.
That's good news.
Qualified for the season. But it was, in all honesty, in all seriousness, it was great to talk to you, and thank you so much for praising the book. It means so much.
Not a problem. It's a well worthy book. And the fact that you mentioned earlier on, you know, I'm nearly 31. I just thought, you're nearly 31. You've got a book. I'm 35 and I write on a website, and that's about it at the moment.
Oh, but you're doing great. It's been great listening to you guys. I really enjoy it. And I will certainly keep up with you guys as we go forward.
Brian, we really appreciate it. And we appreciate everyone for listening and subscribing. Thank you very much. Good night.